funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Living in the White House is an extraordinary privilege, but it is never easy. Every action you take, every word you say is scrutinized by your opponents, certainly, but sometimes even by those within your own party. Imagine how it would be to bear all the social and political burdens that come with occupying the White House, but none of the constitutional powers. Now you have a sense of the life of the First Lady. From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Make no mistake, every modern presidential spouse has had an influence on her husband's tenure, and in most cases has worked at least as hard as he has to help him win the nation's highest office. But if Michelle Obama's characterization of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue as resembling a really nice prison in its limitations on the first family's freedom and privacy is true, the sacrifices of a successful campaign have been just the beginning. Kate Anderson Brower is a former producer for CBS News who spent 4 years covering the Obama White House for Bloomberg News. Her new book details the life in the White House for First Ladies from Jackie Kennedy through Michelle Obama. It just hit the New York Times bestseller list, and it's called First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. Kate, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
The First Lady's responsibilities do not appear in the Constitution. Her title is not technically capitalized. And yet, they have realized over time that they have a great deal of power.
They do. You know, Jackie Kennedy hated the title First Lady. I would say it sounds like a saddle horse. She didn't want anyone to call her First Lady. But then when she came to the White House, she found how much power she had. You know, she thought of herself as really an issue for President Kennedy on the campaign trail, that she, you know, was too rich, too young. She was 31 when they moved into the White House, which is extraordinary to think of. But then once she became First Lady, women all over the country were imitating her style. And she was so important for President Kennedy that on the ride to the inaugural balls, he pushed her forward in the limo and asked the driver to turn on the lights so everyone could see her in the car. You know, she was this glamorous woman. And I started with Jackie because I really am fascinated by her and her relationship with Mamie Eisenhower. And a lot of the book is about these friendships and rivalries between the first ladies and this idea of, you know, is there a flip side of the president's club? Is there a club of women who are the only people on earth who understand the realities of what it's like to live in the White House?
Mamie Eisenhower called Jackie Kennedy that college girl.
Yes, she did not like Jackie. I mean, she was a Republican. She loved living in the White House. It was the only time she really got to spend with Ike Eisenhower because he was always away, you know, during World War II. And so you find that a lot with these women is their husbands are traveling so much. They're campaigning. They're often, you know, senators and congressmen. So in the White House, they really live above the store. And I think that that's something you see again and again. And with the Obamas, it's the same thing. I mean, President Obama comes home for dinner every night. You know, Michelle Obama talks about how wonderful it is for her and her daughters to see him. And in Chicago, they really didn't see him as much because he was commuting back and forth between Springfield and Chicago. So you do see that they live this claustrophobic life in the White House, but they have more time alone with their families, which is kind of a fascinating juxtaposition there.
Secretary Clinton is a notable exception to this, but many of the first ladies have taken pains to say, I'm not particularly political, but a big takeaway for me from this book was that they are all keen politician.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Pat Nixon was so aware of what was going on during Watergate. And it's kind of interesting. You see again and again how the West Wing, the men in the West Wing kind of try to shelter the first ladies. And there's this battle between the East Wing and the West Wing that's in every administration, even now. And someone like Pat Nixon during Watergate, President Nixon's aides didn't want her to even read the newspaper headlines. They were worried about it. And she knew everything that was going on. Rosalynn Carter knew so much about what was going on in the White House. I interviewed her and Walter Mondale, and he said she knew every secret in the White House. There was nothing we kept from her.
And Lady Bird Johnson had her own campaign drain.
10 months ago, on a dreadful day that shook our country, my husband became your president. Since then, he has tried with all that is in him to keep our country on a steady course of economic prosperity, to face the world with firm strength, and to seek practical ways to help those Americans still in need.
Boy, Lady Bird had a tough act to follow.
Oh, it was very difficult for her. And she was very insecure about her looks. You know, she talked about how when she was, when both their husbands were in the Senate, she invited Jackie Kennedy for a ladies' luncheon. And she said, here was this beautiful bird of beautiful plumage among all of us little gray wrens. You know, she did not think she could compare to Jackie's beauty. But you see again and again, I mean, Jackie was also thought her hips were too wide. Lady Bird thought her nose was too big. And these women who we think of as these icons were insecure. And Lady Bird Johnson in particular, that was such a hard transition because they came into a White House in mourning. And, you know, I interviewed her social secretary, this lovely woman, Bess Abel, and she described coming into a White House where there was literally black crepe hanging everywhere. And Lady Bird had to win over West Wing aides. And what she did was she baked loaves of bread and wheeled them up and down the hallways in the West Wing and handed them out to Kennedy's aides and said, please stay with us. We need your support. Because, of course, the Kennedy aides didn't like Johnson. And after the assassination, it was even worse. So she helped LBJ keep them on. And she also helped him win in 1964 with her Lady Bird special. She was the first lady to campaign without her husband. I mean, she was a very fascinating woman.
You mentioned loaves of bread. Many of the first families have had major sticker shock realizing how much they were going to have to pay for the meals that were not associated with any kinds of official events.
Yeah, I mean, I assumed going into this that you know, somehow taxpayers paid for their food, or I wasn't really sure how it worked. But Rosalind Kennedy told me, you know, she remembered getting this bill for $600, and this is back in the 70s, and just being shocked. And she said, that was a lot of money to us, actually. And so they have to pay for every single bit of food. So, you know, I interviewed Barbara Bush, and she talked about a cup of coffee for a friend who came over to visit, and they saw that on their bill. And when I interviewed Steve Ford, Gerald Ford's son, he said, you know, my dad would say, I saw that you had some friends over. Don't think I don't see what's going on around here. Like, they see these bills, and a lot of times they'll ask for leftovers. The Carters especially would ask for leftovers. They just didn't need these elaborate meals every night. And, of course, the First Lady sees the menu on Sunday, and she's really in charge of that. And Rosalind Carter was especially thrifty about the money they were spending.
And they also don't get to keep the gifts that they were given really at all over time. I think most people are aware that something of great value belongs to the country, but would think that a trinket would be okay.
Yeah, I think it's hard for them. I mean, Amy Carter had this, I think it was from the Pope, but it was a small trinket, maybe $100 or something. She wanted to keep it, but had to give it back. And I think that was really difficult for Rosalind Carter. And I think that happens a lot where you would never think that something that maybe is a couple hundred dollars would be an issue. But it's kind of nice that there are those rules in place, I think.
What is it like to try to raise children in a fishbowl like the White House?
You know, Jackie Kennedy said, if you bungle raising your children, I don't think whatever else you do matters very much. And she was just absolutely obsessed with having privacy for her two children in the White House. And that's why Hillary Clinton reached out to Jackie and asked for advice, because she thought she did such a wonderful job with Caroline and John Kennedy Jr. I think it's very, very difficult for the families. And that's why for my first book, The Residence, which was about the butlers and the maids in the White House, I interviewed a lot of them who felt really protective of the children and, you know, very protective of Chelsea Clinton, especially what she was dealing with in the public spotlight, and of the Kennedy children, because I have spoken to some butlers who remembered, you know, reading stories to John Kennedy Jr., just fascinating things like that. They're very protective, and it's really difficult. Steve Ford told me he wrote a letter to Chelsea Clinton and said, I recommend that you become very good friends with your Secret Service agents, because they might be the only people you see on a regular basis. So befriend them. And he said he felt sorry for Chelsea as an only child. And I think that is an issue sometimes. You know, it's easier if you have siblings in the White House.
Because if you are a first child and you want a friend to spend the night, there has to be like a lengthy security check first.
Yeah, there is a security check. And, you know, but the Obama daughters do have sleepovers in the solarium. And when I would interview these resident staffers, they'd say they, you know, it would be just like any suburban house anywhere in the country where you'd see these sleeping bags in the solarium, which is a third floor kind of family room for the first family. So they are, I think Michelle Obama especially tries to keep life as normal as possible.
Where is the spot in the first family's private quarters where the first lady has the opportunity to overlook and actually see into the Oval Office?
That's the dressing room. And so every first lady who comes in, the outgoing first lady will give her a tour. So instead of these notes that presidents leave for each other in the Oval Office, the first ladies don't have such a regimented tradition. What they have is this tour. And so the departing first lady will give the incoming first lady a tour and stand her in this window, which is adjacent to the president and first lady's bedroom. And it's in the first lady's dressing room. And there she will position her where she can see out over the Rose Garden into the Oval Office and see and say, here you can watch your husband work. And so I like to think of these women often kind of in the shadows or behind the drapes watching, you know, because they are really, in a way, the president can get out a lot more. He has more freedom. He has a set, he has a job. These women don't have any job description. And, you know, Rosalynn Carter, when I asked her about her criticism for going to cabinet meetings, and I asked her how difficult that was, and she said, you know, I knew I'd get criticized no matter what I did, so I just did what I wanted to do. And I think that that's true for a lot of these women. They get criticized because there is no role for them. There is no clear description of what they're supposed to be doing in the White House.
Nancy Reagan certainly was involved in, you know, drug prevention, but it seems like she really thought her number one job was taking care of her husband.
She really did, and she was just an incredibly important part of that administration, so much so that she was called the Human Resources Department by one of his aides. And she helped staff the people. She wanted to make sure that the people around the president were moderate Republicans as much as possible, because she knew that he would have to work with a Democratic-controlled Congress. And so she was also very realistic about actually getting things done. She wanted him to talk more to the Soviet Union. This was, you know, during the Cold War. And so she didn't like one of his national security advisors who she thought was too much of a hardliner, and he was fired. And
this is Donald Regan.
His chief of staff, Don Regan, was fired. I mean, again and again, you see where she had a hugely, a profound influence. And I interviewed Ron Reagan, their son, who told me that in a way he felt sorry for his mother because she took a lot of the criticism that his father wouldn't take. You know, Ronald Reagan wanted everyone to love him, and Nancy Reagan didn't really particularly care. She wanted to get things done, and if no one else was going to do it, she would handle it. And so Don Regan is one of those examples where, you know, George H.W. Bush, she writes in her memoirs that George H.W. Bush said, you know, he's a problem. We have to do something about it. And she said, why don't you do something? And he said, no, it's not in my job description. And she wrote, you know, it wasn't in mine either, but someone had to stand up and do it. And so I think that she, in a lot of ways, was very brave. Whether you agree with her politically or not, she really did. I mean, she was called Queen Nancy in the press. A lot of people really did not like her, and I think she really built a wall up around herself in the White House and tried hard not to let it get to her.
Among those who didn't care for her was Barbara Bush.
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly, they really did not get along. Barbara Bush knew very little bit about how the layout of the residence. For 8 years, she was the wife of the vice president. You would have thought that they would have been invited up there quite often, or at least several times, and they really weren't. And George H.W. Bush, in his memoirs, talks about Nancy doesn't like Barbara. She thinks that Barbara is in a different class and thinks of herself. And in a sense, she was. I mean, Barbara Bush, a patrician woman, might have looked at Nancy Reagan as somebody who was cloying her way to the top. And I interviewed Nancy Reagan's personal assistant, who told me, you know, it's like if you and my husband were law partners, it's great if they get along, but you and I don't have to get along. And so that's the kind of way it was in the White House. Barbara and Nancy just never got along. And Barbara even bought a really negative biography of Nancy Reagan and put a different cover on it so that no one would know what she was reading. And Barbara Bush, of course, has a wonderful sense of humor and very funny lady.
We're speaking this hour with Kate Anderson Brower, former reporter for Bloomberg News, who covered the Obama White House for 4 years. Her new book is called First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or follow along on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
I never imagined when we first met 40 years ago that we would develop such a close personal friendship.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, and that was former First Lady Rosalynn Carter speaking at Betty Ford's funeral in 2011.
At that time, Betty was the wife of the Vice President of the United States. As I assumed the responsibilities of First Lady, I had an excellent role model and a tough act to follow. Betty broke new ground in speaking out on women's issues. Her public disclosure of her own battle with breast cancer lifted the veil of secrecy from this terrible disease. She used the influence of the Office of First Lady to promote early detection, and millions of women are in her debt today.
My guest this hour is Kate Anderson Brower, author of the new book, First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. You can follow us along on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC or call 1-800-933-5372. Kate, Rosalynn Carter and Betty Ford would not seem to have had much in common politically, but they became genuinely dear friends.
It's really interesting because in 1976, when they were running, their husbands were running against each other, Betty Ford was watching the Today Show and Rosalynn Carter was doing an interview. And Betty Ford turned to her aide and said, "She looks tired. She has a way of smiling while sticking a knife in your back. There's a saccharine quality to her," which I think is really interesting because these women are the fiercest defenders of their husbands. So back in 1976, Betty Ford and Rosalynn Carter were not friends. They were rivals. And Betty was very upset about leaving the White House. She was there for 2.5 years. But I would say she's one of the most influential first ladies we've had because of what was mentioned in that soundbite with her talking about having a mastectomy, which was something people really didn't talk about. And then also, obviously, what she did after she left the White House, talking about her addiction to painkillers and alcohol and opening the Betty Ford Center. So she was hugely influential. But that rivalry turned into this friendship. And I think there's something really amazing about that. And you see that again and again. I mean, it was so bad that Betty Ford really did not want to give Rosalynn Carter a tour of the White House. And it got really embarrassing because the Carters were staying at Blair House. And President Carter, the incoming president, was already there meeting with Gerald Ford. And the media was waiting. And Rosalynn Carter kept wondering, well, why isn't anyone calling me over for my tour? And it was canceled twice. And then finally, Jimmy Carter called up his wife and said, "Just come over here because it's going to look bad in the press if you don't come over." And Betty was dealing with her own issues at the time, wasn't feeling well that day, and kept canceling it. But I spoke with David Kennerly, who was very close with the Fords and was their official photographer, and he said he remembers standing out there on the North Portico with the Fords when they were welcoming the Carters to the White House, and Betty turning to President Ford and just saying, "Gosh, do we have to do this?" And he said, "You know, yes, we do." So there's a sense that some of the women find it hard to give up the grudge in the family because they really are their husband's fiercest defenders, and they can't really – they feel powerless, I think, to do anything about it.
So that would perfectly lead us into the next question, which is about the relationship between Barbara Bush and Hillary Clinton. The rift between their husbands narrowed to the extent that those two went on the road together for international humanitarian missions. By most accounts, are actually friends, not so with their wife.
It's true. I mean, they have a father-son bond. It's very close. And I was told by two people there's a reason why when Bill Clinton goes to Kennebunkport to visit the Bushes, you know, Hillary Clinton is not with him. This is not Barbara Bush is not someone who forgets things easily or forgives easily. And what happened in 92 during the election, Hillary Clinton, in a Vanity Fair story, talked about this alleged affair that George H.W. Bush had. And she really, it's kind of shocking if you read it, says, you know, well, everyone in Washington's talking about this. And Barbara Bush was livid. And I interviewed a reporter for the Houston Chronicle who went and interviewed Barbara Bush the next day in the residence in the West Sitting Hall, and he described her sitting there very prim and proper, beautifully dressed. And he said, but it was the focus of her day to talk about how how low the Clintons had gone with that accusation, because of course they were dealing with Jennifer Flowers and all these other scandals. And I think Hillary Clinton was very angry about how her private life was being dragged into, you know, out into the public. And so her way of kind of getting back was bringing up this really embarrassing alleged affair. And Barbara Bush is someone who is just so loyal to her husband. She couldn't stand that being brought out into the public. So that's been a very long, cold war between them. They really do not get along, the two of them. Very different women. Again, I think it has very little to do with political party and everything to do with personality.
President Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, of course, was played out very publicly. There were rumors over the years of other presidents who had dalliances. What you discovered was that their wives were not too naive to realize what was going on. Jackie Kennedy even sort of made peace with it by saying, well, am I right about this? At least he knows what he did was wrong, and so I can live with it.
Yeah, I think that they, you know, it's interesting. In an oral history from the Kennedy Library, there's a great description of Jackie Kennedy walking into Evelyn Lincoln's office, and Evelyn Lincoln was JFK's secretary. It's right in the outer oval. So she's walking in with a friend of hers, and they're speaking French together. And she points to this young girl and says, this is the woman who's supposedly sleeping with my husband. And this is something, I mean, we don't necessarily, she said that in French, but we don't necessarily think of Jackie Kennedy as someone who was completely aware of what was going on. And who knows if she knew the extent to which things were happening, but she was certainly aware that her husband was having affairs. And this is someone who grew up with a father who was, you know, an alcoholic and cheated on her mother. And so I think she was kind of, she just had a different approach to what a marriage is. And I think that each woman, including Lady Bird Johnson, I mean, LBJ was not a saint and not easy to live with. In fact, Joe Califano, an assistant to the president, told me he was essentially a manic depressive, and that Lady Bird Johnson was the only person who could kind of calm him and level him out. So these women have a really important role to play. And in a lot of cases, their husbands would never have gotten, I think in almost every case, would never have become president if it hadn't been for them.
The idea of presidential wives, first ladies being friends is very appealing. And sometimes friendships spring up among people that you wouldn't imagine would have much in common. Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton are not close friends, but Michelle Obama and Laura Bush have formed a bond.
They haven't. And I think it's because they are more similar. They're not very political, either one of them. Michelle Obama really is not happy about living in the White House. You know, she wants to get out. It was a sacrifice she made because she thinks of her husband as being exceptional. I think Laura Bush also wasn't particularly happy about being in the White House either. Neither one of them is political. And Laura Bush, you know, has come to Michelle Obama's defense. When Michelle Obama, during the 2008 campaign, talked about being proud of her country for the first time, that quote that got her in a lot of, you know, trouble in the press. Laura Bush came out and said, I'm sure that's not what she meant. You know, you just have to think about every little word you say as a candidate's spouse is going to be parsed in the media. So there's a lot of sympathy that I think Laura Bush has for Michelle Obama. And I interviewed people like Reggie Love, who was President Obama's body man, who was like a son to the Obamas. And he said, look, she was a woman who's worked her entire adult life. She was highly accomplished, Princeton, Harvard educated, was making $300,000 in Chicago, had a life and a career. And now she can't work because we all know that Americans don't want to have a first lady who's taking on really serious political issues. When Hillary Clinton did it with health care, poll numbers went way down, and she regretted that and confessed to Laura Bush that she wished she didn't have an office in the West Wing. So I think there's a sense of we want these women to be kind of in a box, and it's hard for them because so many of them are very, very intelligent and accomplished.
Let's listen to Michelle Obama and Laura Bush at the African First Lady Summit in Tanzania in 2013.
You have an opportunity to speak to your passions and to really design and be very strategic about the issues you care most about. And I've just found it just a very freeing and liberating opportunity.
No, but what I didn't really understand was how people would listen to the First Lady. And right after the attacks of September 11th, when I gave the presidential radio address to talk about women in Afghanistan, And right after that, I was in a department store with my daughter, Jenna. She was a freshman in college, and I was in Austin seeing her. And we went to a department store, and the women who sold cosmetics at the department store said, "Thank you so much, Ms. Bush. Thank you for speaking for the women in Afghanistan."
How do they choose the first ladies? How do they choose what their issues will be to work on during their husband's terms in office?
I mean, in a lot of cases, it's very personal. I mean, for Rosalynn Carter, it was about mental health because she had a relative who was mentally ill and she saw the need to do something about it. And I think for Laura Bush, it's really interesting because after 9/11, she was the first lady to give the presidential radio address. And she does care and she's very passionate about women in Afghanistan. So that was almost an unexpected thing that happened for her and not an issue that she chose going into the White House, but because of world events, it became our issue. There is no one way of doing it. I mean, the incoming First Lady staff will meet with the outgoing East Wing staff and they'll go over binders of information and events like the Easter egg roll and Christmas and all these things that they have to do. And then there are programs that they say, if you'd like to continue them, here are some programs. But they have to pick an issue they walk such a fine line. I think Michelle Obama did it really expertly with the healthy eating campaign that she, you know, the Let's Go and Let's Move campaign. It's interesting because it is controversial in some ways. You know, she's taking on big food companies, and at the beginning it was controversial, certainly, but it's also something that I think most people can embrace, you know. So it's a really difficult thing for them to pick a signature issue that's just, you know, something they personally care about, not too controversial, but something they feel like they can really make a difference supporting.
I know many first families have been frustrated by the constant presence of Secret Service, understanding why it's important. I've also wondered what it feels like when suddenly they don't have that protection available to them anymore, and if it's a little bit frightening.
Well, the Nixons couldn't wait to get rid of the Secret Service agents. You know, they hated feeling like people were listening in on them. But I'm sure, you know, who knows what the Obamas will choose to do. I know I was able for this book to interview their head butler, George Haney, who retired a year ago. And he talked about how when the Obamas want to eat dinner outside on the Truman balcony, sometimes he would say no because there were too many people gathered at the South Lawn Gate. You know, he would position them behind these giant columns. It's all of this kind of these minute details. And you're really not allowed to live a normal life at all. I can imagine you'd want to have more freedom, but you'd also want to have to feel some sense of security, especially when you have young kids. It's got to be really difficult.
So the staff members, the domestic staff members in the White House, tend to stay from one administration to the next. They are not political appointees of any kind. Do they have favorites? Have they had favorites over the years?
Absolutely. I mean, almost to a person, and I interviewed more than 50 of them for the residents, it told me George H.W. Bush and Barbara Bush. And these were not Republicans or Democrats. I still can't tell, you know, one of them told me they're an independent Republican. You know, it's whoever wins mm-hmm. is who they support. The Bushes were the favorites because I think it's because they were very kind to the staff. They would ask about your family. If it was late, they would tell the ushers, why don't you go home and have dinner with your wife? Things like that other families like the Clintons might not think to do. And I think that's because the Bushes grew up. I mean, they have been surrounded by a certain level of wealth. You know, George H.W. Bush, his father was a senator. Barbara Bush grew up in Rye, New York, in a wealthy family. So you have the Clintons and the Obamas who weren't used to having staff around them and don't particularly like being waited on in that way. So it becomes a little bit more awkward for them, which is interesting.
I have to tell you, I would assume that they would be required to sign some kind of non-disclosure agreement. How did you get them to talk to you, and were there things that they simply wouldn't say?
Well, they were all former, except for one current part-time butler. So the current folks you cannot talk to, and they didn't sign anything. You know, I'm not sure if that's changed now, but they absolutely couched everything in as positive a way as you could imagine, even negative stories, you know, about arguments during the Clinton administration, for instance, were said in a way to, you know, well, they could understand why Hillary Clinton would have been tense because of what was going on, and they felt sorry for for her going through this public embarrassment during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, you know. So there were many things that they wouldn't say, but there was enough there that I thought was really fascinating to kind of give you a glimpse into what these people are really like.
It would be strange. I don't have servants, but,
to
have, an argument, a discussion with your spouse and think somebody might be outside the door with their ear pressed to it, waiting to tell a journalist or a historian.
It's got to be very difficult now. And I interviewed the head housekeeper who was there up through the bushes. And she said that she trained all of the housekeepers to, just do not speak unless spoken to. If the president and the first lady are having a discussion, don't try to make their bed or try to do something else. They have to be, and some aides don't really last long there. People have been fired because they get too nervous, too self-conscious around the most famous people probably in the country, So it takes a special person, and they also are so discreet and so just kind of protective of the American presidency and the institution and having respect for it no matter who is president. None of them quit, from one administration to the next. And I think that's incredible that they stay on, even if they personally disagree with whoever they're serving.
How do first ladies learn the kind of protocol they need? I remember the big kerfluffle when Michelle Obama hugged the Queen, because this is what Americans do when you meet someone you're expecting to be fond of. And this is not, you don't hug the Queen.
There are so many little things. Like Michelle Obama brought an assistant with her for her tour of her first tour of the White House. And Laura Bush said, this is really just for Michelle and I, can you please excuse us? And that's because she didn't know. You wouldn't know. You're not supposed to necessarily bring a staffer with you for that tour. I think it's just, they just have to learn it. Eventually, their social secretaries are there to really help. When I interviewed Juliana Smoot, who was the Obama's one of their first social secretaries, she talked about, Christmas was coming, and it was in June or July, and the florist came up to her and said, what's happening with Christmas for flowers? And she said, are you kidding me? It's July. And they said, we're actually really behind. We need to plan that. So sometimes it's kind of done kind of happenstance. And she said, thank God the florist told me about it, because I would never have thought about Christmas in July. So some of it is just, they just kind of have to wing it a little bit. But there is a sort of official, there's a lot of discussion between the chief of staffs, between the first ladies.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Kate Anderson Brower about her new book, First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or follow along on social media with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're in the nation's capital all week. You can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC. You can also send email to think@kera.org. My guest this hour is Kate Anderson Brower. She's a former producer for CBS News and former White House reporter for Bloomberg News. Her new book is called First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. We have an email to think@kera.org from Joey in Denton, who says, being born in 1984, I was too young to remember anything of the Reagan years, but I've always wondered, during their time in the White House, how was the First Lady's use of astrology viewed by the public?
Well, it was very controversial, and it didn't come out until Don Regan wrote a book. And of course, Don Regan had a very difficult relationship with Nancy Reagan, because he was President Reagan's chief of staff, and she helped to get him fired. So in his memoir, he talked about it and exposed it, and it was a huge bestseller, that Nancy Reagan had consulted this astrologer, Joan Quigley, who she started consulting after President Reagan was almost assassinated. So, I mean, this was, she called it the lost year after the assassination attempt, where she was just consumed with fear every time he would leave. She just could not calm down. These were people who were so devoted to each other that one usher told me that he would come up at the end of the night and the two of them would be sitting holding hands watching, you know, Who's the Boss on television. Just very sweet. And no one would ever have seen them. They were sitting there holding hands privately. It's a very loving, genuinely close relationship. And she was also someone who was so protective of her husband that when he went on trips, she would give him 3x5 cards saying, remember to do X, Y, and Z. You know, she was very much involved in what his day-to-day life was. And so she did consult an astrologer, and they would have these color-coded days on a calendar. Green days, it was safe to travel. Yellow days were iffy. Red days were no-goes. And so this really affected his actual schedule. And but I think in retrospect, you know, the nation was really, we were guarded and not really let in on how close the president was to dying. Nancy Reagan wanted to stay the night with him at the hospital, but was convinced by presidential aides not to. And instead, she went back home to the White House and slept with one of his shirts because she wanted to feel him close to her. And so that was because it would have just looked really scary if she had stayed the night, and no one wanted to kind of let the American public know how very close the president had come to dying. So I think in retrospect, you could kind of understand why she did that. She also she broke a rib, actually, in the White House, because after he was shot, she wanted to bring him one of his favorite photos. So she went up to the third floor game room, climbed up on a ladder by herself. There was a waiting car outside, and she fell off and broke a rib and never, you know, complained about it to a doctor or anything. And so the people on the staff knew about it, a couple of them. And this was someone who was so devoted that she would do that. And she, you know, I think that you can have some sympathy for how difficult that situation was for her, and how a lot of these first ladies, you know, they never know if they're what's going to happen when their husbands are out there traveling, which they constantly are doing. And the same with Gerald Ford. I mean, he survived two assassination attempts. And in the book I have that, you know, when John Kennedy was assassinated, where was Nancy Reagan and where was Betty Ford during that time? And Betty Ford was in her living room, very upset and emotional. And Nancy Reagan was driving along a highway in Los Angeles. And little did they know that, you know, several decades later, they would be facing their own husband's possible death. So they're really bound by this experience and this kind of trauma that I think would affect anybody.
When they are all together for, usually it's the funeral of someone very important, a head of state, does anything other than polite speech pass between them?
Well, it depends on who it is. I mean, there's a photo in the book that I like because it shows Rosalynn Carter kind of sitting on the outside, Nancy Reagan looking off into the distance. And then it shows Lady Bird Johnson and Hillary Clinton kind of whispering to each other, and Betty Ford and Barbara Bush whispering to each other. And I think it says a lot because Nancy Reagan and Rosalynn Carter are two women who were kind of on the outside of this sisterhood. They didn't do a lot to be part of it. Rosalynn Carter especially feels like first ladies like Hillary Clinton and Michelle Obama haven't reached out to her enough to ask for her advice. She's the wife of a one-term president. Maybe that's part of it. But especially with healthcare issues, she really felt that she should be brought in more during the healthcare reform in the Obama White House, and then during Hillary Clinton's healthcare initiative. She thought that she should have been consulted more. So it depends on with whom. Some of them are genuinely friends. Lady Bird Johnson had a framed photo of Betty Ford on her nightstand up until Lady Bird's death. And this was someone who was very, very close. They would see each other several times a year, and there are these great letters between the first ladies that show that. But it really depends on the women you know, who you're talking about. Lady Bird Johnson in particular was kind of like the grande dame of the first ladies. And she has these incredible letters that she wrote to many of them. And in the margins, she would write in all caps, "Do not answer," because she didn't want, you know, especially when she was writing to, for instance, Jackie Kennedy, when she found out that she had cancer, she wrote to this really moving note to Jackie saying, "Do know that there are an army of people who love you." And I was struck that she wrote, "Do not answer," in the margins, because she knew how busy Jackie was, how many notes she was getting. And these women all understand the obligations of being a former first lady. They have lots of things that they're doing, you know, ribbon cutting, lectures, all these things they get asked to do. So they have an understanding of how hectic their schedules are. And I thought that was very sweet.
Should we pay the first lady?
No, I don't think so. I think that, but I do think it would be nice if there was more of leniency there, where the American public allowed them to work. Like, if they have a job that's not a huge conflict of interest. I mean, it's difficult if you're a lawyer, but if you're a teacher, for instance, or even a business person, if you're not doing something directly related to the government and to your husband's policies, although it's very, very tricky since there's so many things that could be conflicts of interest, it would be nice if we allowed them to have careers. And if we have a first gentleman, I think he'll certainly have, you know, more leeway. But of course, it could be a former president. So it's a completely different, you can't even really compare that. It would be very interesting if it was just a businessman and we could see what would happen. But the fact that it could be Bill Clinton makes it entirely, you know, you can't really compare it to the first ladies of the past.
Can you imagine them walking into a dinner if Secretary Clinton were to win the presidency and be announced as president and President Clinton?
It will be incredible. The fact that we don't even know what the title would be, what his title would be, you know, first gentleman. He jokes that it could be first laddie. You know, it's so unclear. But when I interviewed sort of members of Hillary's inner circle, and they call themselves Hillary Land, including her second chief of staff, Milan Verveer, she said, you know, that President Clinton is such a great negotiator, has so many relationships around the world. He'll be dispatched as kind of an envoy, a diplomat. Envoy. He'll be very useful to the administration. He loves to travel. When I interviewed Walter Mondale, who was Carter's vice president, but also a friend of the Clintons, he said, "How is this going to work? I mean, Bill Clinton is somewhat unorganizable. You know, you don't really, he notoriously in the White House, the staff called it Clinton standard time because he just took he was often late. And if you really enjoyed talking to someone, something that's supposed to take 10 minutes would be a half an hour, you know, on the schedule. So he's not someone who you can fit into a box. But her friends have said that he would be just a wonderful, wonderful kind of ambassador almost for the administration if she is elected.
Okay, so if it were Bill Clinton as the first gentleman, he would certainly be a different example. But at some point in the future, there will be a man who is married to the president of the United States. Do you think it's time to let go of some of the kind of gendered expectations of the first lady? Like, it would be hard to imagine, you know, a man who had a career being expected to turn that down mm-hmm. the way women have been expected to in modern mm-hmm. times and host teas. Not that there is anything wrong with any of that, but there's a question of choice. And women who've had careers haven't really been given the choice ultimately to pursue those mm-hmm. when their husbands have been elected.
I personally think that you should be allowed to work. And I think we would see that if it was a man, even if it wasn't Bill Clinton. I think you would see that. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton will probably hire a very experienced social secretary to pick out China and flower arrangements. And like you said, not that there's anything wrong with that, because those are actually important things, you know, and who sits next to whom. I mean, these are important parts of a diplomacy, really. But the idea, and Laura Bush has said it's not a question of whether or not the first lady should be paid. It's a question of whether or not they should be paid to have their own career. And I think we would see a man be allowed to do that more easily than we've ever seen a woman take on that role. So, but again, I think Bill Clinton is just, it's going to be a very hard, it's a hard comparison to make between him and any other first lady before him. first spouse.
I found it really poignant that Jackie Kennedy had enjoyed being in the White House and then couldn't bear to go back for a very long time.
Yeah, she wouldn't go back until Pat Nixon invited her back for the official portrait unveiling. And, you know, Lady Bird Johnson, a fellow Democrat, had tried for years to get Jackie Kennedy. She even dedicated a garden to Jackie Kennedy, the First Lady's garden, to her. And Jackie sent her mother instead to the dedication ceremony because it was just too painful for her to return to the White House. She would direct her drivers to avoid going anywhere near the White House. She did not want to see it. But then in 1971, Pat Nixon invited her. And this is something every first family typically does. You know, the famous photo image of JFK, the portrait. And she went, and it was this very moving dinner that she had with the Nixons. And the Nixon daughters showed Caroline and John John around the White House. They were 10 and 13 at the time. And there are these wonderful thank you notes that John John wrote the day after the visit, where he said he thought that the Nixons' dogs could smell his dogs on him. And he talked about sitting on the Lincoln bedroom, on the bed in the Lincoln bedroom where his father had slept. And he talked about, you know, wishing he would get good grades in school because he made a wish. I mean, very sweet things a 10-year-old boy would say. And if you see the stationery, there's this imposing, you know, John F. Kennedy Jr. monogram, but written, you know, in the hand of a 10-year-old boy. It's very sweet. But Jackie only went because Pat Nixon promised her there would be no press there. And so Helen Thomas somehow got wind of the story. And the Nixon's press secretary said, you know, you'll get an exclusive interview with Pat Nixon if you do not reveal this. And so it's amazing because these are two women that were, you know, standard bearers of different political parties, could not be more different personality style-wise, but they came together. And Jackie wrote Pat this letter where she said, you know, can you imagine the gift you gave us? The day I dreaded for years came to be the best day I've spent with my family. And Rose Kennedy later wrote to Pat Nixon saying, you know, thank you for making the people I love most in the world feel comfortable. And I think that does speak to how these different women can really have sympathy. And Pat Nixon, certainly better than anyone, could understand how difficult that would be for Jackie Kennedy to return to this place where she was really happy with her husband, and where this kind of fairy tale ended very suddenly.
What did you learn about the relationships between American first ladies and their counterparts overseas? This is a whole other level of complication.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, I mean, famously, so Michelle Obama was talking to Carla Bruni and described, supposedly in a book that came out in France, and said, you know, living in the White House is hell, you know, and that was published there. So I think sometimes they know that they can't even have candid conversations with people, with the first ladies sort of in other countries. So I think it's very difficult for them. And there really is nothing quite like being the first lady of the United States. They're so scrutinized and so much on the world stage that I think there's not real, unless you're talking about the royal family, there's really nothing else you can compare it to.
Do you think this is a job that no one in her right mind would want?
I certainly wouldn't. I can't imagine. I don't think Michelle Obama particularly wanted it. And that's another thing that I think is interesting, that she's so ready to leave and Hillary Clinton can't wait to get back in. And again, that speaks to how different these women are. But yeah, I think it's tremendously difficult. You have to have such a thick skin. And no matter what you do, you're going to be criticized and sort of pitted against your East Wing staff is going to have issues with the West Wing staff. You see that. I mean, Michelle Obama's East Wing staff refers to themselves as Guam because sometimes they are left out of important conference calls and meetings. And again, it's kind of a battle of the sexes, and it's incredible that this still goes on today. I'm not sure how far we've come in that way, that you still have the men of the West Wing kind of duking it out with the East Wing staffers and making them feel like second-class citizens.
Kate Anderson Brower is a former producer for CBS News. She also spent 4 years covering the Obama White House for Bloomberg News. Her new book is called First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and executive producer Jeff Whittington. Our team back in Dallas includes Shelley Canavy, Stephanie Kuo, and Tori Whitley. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and the social media hashtag all this week is ThinkInDC. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.